welcome back to the Blue Jays Plus podcast. Since we are doing our midweek special, our midseason specials, yesterday you heard our pitcher grades, and that means that today you will be hearing our hitter grades. Once we're done our hitter grades, we will be back with an interview with Ben Lindbergh about catcher framing and J.P. Arencibia and his improvements therein. So getting started, we're going to start off with the aforementioned J.P. Arencibia. Go ahead, Chris.
I gave him a D. I almost gave him a C, but I was going to go with C because I didn't want to ignore the great first month that he had, where only Bautista and Edwin outshined him. And with the improvements and whatnot that he's made recently, I just couldn't do it because in between all that, he was beyond dreadful, so I had to give him a D.
Well, I gave him a D as well, but unlike you, I was going to give him an F because even as good as that first month was, he's been so dreadful that his overall numbers are still equally terrible. I mean, as we went through a couple, like it was last week, about him having the lowest on-base percentage other than Vernon Wells in 20 years. But given the defensive improvements that we've seen from him over the past month, as we will talk to Mr. Lindbergh about, I bumped him up to a D. That's pretty much the only thing that saved him from an F, as well as potentially another player on this team who was even worse, who we'll get to later.
Which I'm sure everybody already knows.
Yeah, and who Steve McEwen disagreed with me, thought I should have given him a C, but we'll get to that later. Next, let's go to the combined backup catcher of Henry Blanco and Josh Tolley.
I went with a B because, to me, what they expected out of them, I'm not positive that they would have expected them to hit at all. They obviously want them to catch Dickey and only Dickey because they've basically gotten no starts.
I was amazed that Tolley started against Masterson.
Yeah, and that was strictly because they wanted to stack lefties.
Yeah.
And then other than that, there was the one start that Blanco had for Burley. Arencibia is the main guy, and personally, I think he catches too much. I think they need to give him more rest. And with a guy like Tolley up, you know, he's proven in the past that he can slap some singles around. Why not put him in there, you know, twice a week instead of just once? But whatever, I say B just because I don't think that they had many expectations. Catch Dickey, do it well. That's pretty much it for me.
I gave them a D, just like Arencibia. I didn't have any hope for Henry Blanco, but when they signed Blanco, they were definitely expecting more than him to be released in June. And he was not released because Tolley was playing so well that he forced their hands. And then since Tolley's come up, he's been, you know, debatably the worst hitter in the majors. I'm fairly confident that we won't be dealing with Tolley for very much longer. I have a feeling that we might see AJ Jimenez up very, very soon. And I'm rather hopeful of that because defensively he's supposed to be ready and he can't be any worse than those two behind.
I saw him today. He was very good.
Yep.
I was very impressed with what I saw, but the, you know, it kind of, you're kind of, you know, you held back a little bit because of Dickey for 2 years. I mean, you can't just throw any catcher back there.
I think a guy who has the defensive reputation that Jimenez has, because, I mean, it would be different if they had a real ace catcher catching Dickey at the moment, but I don't need to tell you that Josh Tolley is not a good catcher.
He is no ace catcher.
No. So
and I can feel that. I mean, if you've got a defensive stud, you would think that he is good enough where he will be able to handle the knuckleball. So, yeah, I can totally see that.
One thing that I would actually have liked to have seen them do in the offseason is to sign a knuckleballer of any description to put with Jimenez in the minor leagues. Just who cares if he's getting beat around in Double A, just give him experience catching a knuckleball of any sort. Signs, whatever. Whoever is out there who can, or teach someone to do it. But that's beside the point. Next, we get to a couple positives. We go to Edwin Encarnacion.
Oh, A plus, all the way.
Because I give him a B plus.
Let me explain why I was so high on him is because I think now obviously they were high enough that they liked what they saw and the changes that they made with his swing, that this is the Edwin that we've always thought was there. I know a lot of us Jays fans saw that potential in him, myself included, and there was just some key adjustments to be made. They made it last year. They signed him to the extension. So obviously they had a lot of faith in him. But did they have faith that he wouldn't regress just a little bit? Probably not. So I'm thinking that he's gone above and beyond and just continued on his last year's tear. And he's been the best hitter on the team, better than Jose Bautista. So I'm thinking that's why he was... I'm going to go ahead and assume that they thought he would have regressed just a little bit, maybe, but still been obviously worth the extension and still been a monster in the middle of the lineup, just not this good.
Yeah, he's just sort of done pretty much what I expected him to do. I might not be taking the team's expectations in quite as much, but he's been outstanding. I guess I may just be a little more difficult a grader than you are, grading on a bit of a curve. But one thing that I might have overlooked at the time is him going back to third base for those few games and allowing the team some more flexibility, because in those games he was quite good at third base, which really surprised me. So I might change that. I might go to an A-, but we're quibbling. Very, very small differences here. Next up, Adam Lind. And I gave Adam Lind an A. Had this been a month ago, it would have been an A-plus easy. He's just kind of regressed a little bit, so an A. But just a hair away from being an A-plus.
I completely agree. And, yes, he has started to look a little bad recently and regressed a little bit into some pretty bad at-bats that, you know, he's starting to chase a little bit. Look at the last 2 weeks, he's been the worst hitter on the team. 2% walk rate, 33 runs created plus, 209 on base percentage. I mean, that's the last 2 weeks. I mean, slumps are slumps, but he's looked like the Adam Lind that we've been used to the past couple of years. So that's a little discouraging, but at this point, at the break, how could you not give him at least an A?
Yeah, the concerning thing is because the big narrative early in the year was his changed approach to the plate, where up until June he had 21 walks and 23 strikeouts. And since then he has 4 walks and 36 strikeouts.
He started to hack again out of nowhere.
I mean, in June you couldn't blame him for hacking because he hit 350, 360, 620.
Yeah.
So if you're hitting, you know, that many home runs, hack away. But it's something to keep an eye on as we go forward, because we really don't want to see him turn back into the pumpkin that he was previously. I want to see if I can find his right-left splits. Yeah, the right-left thing, he has only got 48 plate appearances this year, but I'm sorry, 56 plate appearances, and he's been almost as good against lefties as he has against righties. Oh, wait.
No, not at all.
Wait, how is this possible?
He's been much better against righties than against lefties.
No, you know what it is. He, against left-handed starters, he is hitting 370, 390, 620.
Okay.
And against left-handers overall, he's hitting 280, 280, 393. That can't be possible.
I mean, it's 56 plate appearances. He hasn't taken a walk against a lefty yet.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a weighted on base of under 300. Overall on base, 286.
You know what I think these stats are? These stats are taking into account when he comes in off the bench to pinch hit against righties. That's what's screwing me up.
But he had a tiny little period there where he was even hitting lefties for a few weeks, but... Overall, the half, he's been a monster against righties and what we expected him against lefties.
Yeah, very much a very pleasant surprise This side of Brett Cecil, he's probably the biggest pleasant surprise on the team. Next, we go to second baseman Meiser Esturiz, or Macer, I suppose. go ahead. What do you have on Esturiz?
Despite his good few weeks, I still gave him a D because he was just absolutely dreadful up until a couple weeks ago. Just about everything that he was doing. I was hard on him the moment he was signed. I haven't liked it at all, but it grew on me if he did what he's done his whole career, and if he was signed to be, you know, just a utility guy. He's been one of the best in the past decade, and I was okay with that part of it, but he's proving why he's not a starter. And again, even though he's been on just a tiny little bit of a, you know, a streak here and there, he still falls back into being terrible again, and he just hasn't done anything well. And I cannot understand the whole moving to third base thing. I don't like it. But
we will get into that, or we might have gotten into that more aggressively in our first show of the week. But no one understands that. It doesn't make any sense. But I gave him a C. I gave him a C minus. His wins above replacement are some of the most deceiving in the league because Fangraphs has him as the sixth worst defender in the league. And honestly, I just don't buy that. I know he has not been good, but their defensive metrics are very shaky, especially when they have Bonifacio as half as bad as him.
Well, I certainly agree with that, but he has shown me so far this year that he started to lose a step, not last year, but the year before, and then he really slowed down last year, and he has just not been able to move very well this year. Even at third, like, you know, he'll make a couple plays here and there when he was hot for a few games, but other than that, he just doesn't seem to have any of the range left. And his arm is just dreadful too.
Yeah, he's got to play second base. We're gonna harp on that a whole bunch more. But I'm encouraged. He's hitting really well in July, which is obviously a small sample, but he was even starting to turn it around a little bit in June. I have faith going forward, and I was the opposite. I quite like the signing, but I think he is stretched as an everyday player, and he's on pace to play his most games in any season. So that's something that we might want to watch going forward, because
that's one of the things that concerned me was when he was signed. I'm like, well, he's obviously signed to be the starter, and you know, he's regressed 2 years in a row, and he's only getting older. So that's why I didn't understand the signing.
Well, at the time that he was signed, or during the offseason, I did not think he was going to be the starter because I thought that Emilio Bonifacio was going to be the starter. And why don't you beat him up first?
Yeah, well, I gave him an F, and a little bit of his bias too, because I'm quite butthurt about it because I had him penciled in as a starter. I liked what I saw out of Bonifacio. We all knew that he wasn't good with the glove, but you know, his speed and whatnot could make up for some range and a little bit of lessons there at second base, and you know, he could get better, which he did. He actually improved a lot with after that first week. I think a lot of people remember that first week.
First impressions make a big deal.
Yeah, the first week was dreadful, but after that, he really improved, and he can get to a lot of balls because of his speed. But yeah, when that trade was made, I saw him as a nice little cornerstone. You know, he showed like 3 years in a row that he's an on-base guy. He is an absolute burner. He'll steal a million bases for you. And then he comes to Toronto, and everything completely changes. I was looking at his contact numbers, and I don't know what they did to him. I don't know what they are trying to do with him, but he is not taking pitches. He is swinging at everything. It's just, he just is the complete opposite player of what he showed in Miami. Now he's never going to be this great player, but given the options at second base, I thought, okay, showing what he's shown, give him a chance to start see what he can do at the bottom of the order, you know, getting on base and stealing bases and whatnot, and try not to screw up too bad in the field. That's what I expected going into the season. And if he did, that's okay, because he got his tourists to take over. But he has just been awful. I mean, beyond awful at the plate. Like, not playable awful at the plate. That's how bad it's been.
49 WRC plus. My biggest concern with Bonifacio is his base stealing. Last year, he was 30 for 33 stealing bases. And this year, he's 11 for 16, including getting thrown out twice yesterday, which would be Saturday at this point, as we're recording on Sunday. If he's not running, he's not doing anything for this team. And you could chalk that up to some organizational philosophy, because they're generally not a team that runs all that much. But when you've got Rajay Davis on the team running as well as he ever has before, I can't really cut Bonifacio any slack there.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, he gives you positional value, but when the things that he does well, he's just lost in Toronto, and it's frustrating because we see it so often. I mean, look at the starting rotation, which we've did already. You know, how do these guys come to Toronto and lose their ability to play baseball all of a sudden? It's incredibly frustrating to see. And he's just one because of what, again, for what he's done the past like 3 years in a row, and all of a sudden just go the complete opposite route. I mean, like you said, like a 49 runs created plus, 250 on base percentage, 4% walk rate. Like, what happened to the 9% walk rate and the 360 on base percentage?
Yeah, his walk rate's been cut in half. His strikeout rate is at a career high.
And look at his contacts. He's swinging at everything all of a sudden.
And his BABIP is at 260, which for someone with his amount of speed is just totally unacceptable. Someone who should be able to beat out infield singles. I can't think of very many infield singles he's beaten out all year.
And of course, his slap hits that used to fall are going directly at corner outfielders too. That's another problem. But still, he's still completely changed his approach to the plate, and I can't figure out why it's not being changed. I mean, maybe they are working with him, but I don't know how you suddenly lose that.
And he's a guy who needs to be tendered a contract this offseason to avoid arbitration or to qualify for arbitration, and I don't see how they can. So
he's quietly had a good couple weeks, but obviously that's going to have to – I mean, that's just going to have to boom in the second half. So, yeah, huge disappointment.
Let's move on from one disappointment to potentially another in Jose Reyes. I did not grade Jose Reyes. I gave him an incomplete because, frankly, he's been everything as advertised at the plate. And, frankly, even in the field, I think he's been fairly decent. But when a guy misses as much time as he has, I just don't know what to do with him. So I didn't.
I didn't grade him either. I found it very difficult to grade a guy who just kind of came back and, you know, 120 plate appearances. Like you said, he's been everything that you expect Reyes to be. Maybe not so much since he's come back because the ankle's still not healthy, so he hasn't been moving very well. You know, there's a couple of balls that, you know, even though his defense isn't a very good reputation, there were a couple of balls in the Baltimore series that you'd expect even him to get to. And he didn't get to, and he just doesn't look comfortable yet on that ankle. He's not really attempting stolen bases and whatnot. So,
I mean, since he's come back, he's hitting 300 in July with, you know, 460 slugging percentage. Already hit two home runs, so he looks to be back. So, fingers crossed that stays like that for the rest of the year, and we can be positive on him at the end of the year because I want to watch him play because he's really, really fun.
Because as of right now, he's pretty much the key to that whole trade.
Yep.
When you really think about it, Bonifacio and JJ could both be gone. You're left with
Burley is a negative value at this point because of his contract.
Yeah.
I like Burley. Him as a pitcher, but he's just overpaid because Jeffrey Loria backloaded his contract
Shockingly, and now traded him away. Didn't see that coming.
Just not at all.
Unbelievable. So from Reyes, we go to Munenori Kawasaki. And why don't you lead the charge on him?
Well, you know, as much as I can't stand the hype around him and whatnot, I had to give him an A because, you know, all they wanted out of him was to be a fill-in. They just needed some guy who wasn't a complete wreck at shortstop, and he did exactly that and a little bit better, even though I think, you know, his offensive value was incredibly overrated. He did do better than any level of his career for the short time that he was here. It's hard for me not to look at that and go, nobody expected him to do that. But I'm glad that he's gone again. So,
I went with a B+, and the only reason it's not an A is, frankly, because of the hype machine that was driving me crazy. When we talked to Jeff Sullivan, a few months ago now, the reports that we got from Sullivan were that this guy is the worst player in the major leagues.
Yeah.
Can't hit the ball out of the infield, doesn't have the arm to play shortstop.
We saw that. We did see that. In my opinion, I saw a lot of a very lack of range and a very terrible arm, but
I don't think it hurt us nearly as much as I was expecting it to, though.
No, not at all, but I definitely did see that.
And then at the plate, I think his approach was very key to the team turning things around in June, because taking pitches was something that no one on the team was doing, except for maybe Adam Lind.
Yeah.
And so I think that sort of change of culture was a major impact. But, you know, I had no expectations, and he was about as good as you can get.
And again, you got to imagine that the team didn't exactly have expectations either. They just needed a body out there. So.
Yeah, and I'm willing to give him some credit for apparently being the greatest person in the world. Here, you know, I'm expecting he's going to go down to Buffalo and cure cancer and, you know.
Yeah.
Send him to Vancouver, send him to Lansing, and maybe he can lay his hands on Roberto Osuna and fix his elbow. So
please do that.
Brett Lowry. Brett Lowry's next, and I gave Brett Lowry a D. We've been waiting for Brett Lowry to break out after we saw it in his first appearance in the majors. But this year he has regressed. And, you know, since he's come back this past week or so, or last couple games, nothing's changed at the plate. Everything is moving all over the place. You see him go back to the bench, and he's frustrated, and he's throwing water bottles around, and I'm very tired of it. And moving him to second base doesn't make any sense, because they've taken the one thing that he is really good at and thrown that up in the air. So
I too gave him a D, because I think that this was the year I predicted him to have a breakout year at the plate. I liked what I saw last September. I liked what I saw in the very, very short stint that he had in spring training before he went off to the WBC and got hurt. And then he came back, and it was the same problems at the plate as it was last year. I believe it was Mottola that said he tries to hit the ball at 45 feet instead of letting everything happen, and that's exactly right. I couldn't say it better myself. He is out in front of pitches, and he's already rolling, and he just kills worms. Since he's been back up, I think it's two games or three games?
Two.
It's just the same thing. He is out in front of pitches away and just drills them into the ground. He got his first base hit today, but it was only because they were in double play. They were at double play depth, and it just happened to find the hole. It was the same. Like, there's nothing to get excited about there. And I don't know. Like, you've seen little pieces here and there. There was the Boston series where he was absolutely lighting up the pitching and just killing balls, and they were hit directly at people, unfortunately. Even the last week before he hurt his ankle, he was best hitter on the team that for that week. So we've seen flashes of it. It's there. but the results aren't there. So it's impossible for me not to give him a D because we expected him to be an all-star on defense, which he's been, but they expected him to do that. They certainly expected this year to be like, okay, well, you've had your year. We expect big things from you at the plate because that's what got you to the big leagues, so let's see that. So I can't imagine anything but disappointment from the organization overall. No, of course, they'll never admit it, but I can't imagine them being happy about watching him just regress deeper and deeper. And like you said, you can see it every single time he goes to the bench, and he's fighting himself right now. But it's so frustrating because the talent is there.
It's weird, too, because as he was coming up, all you heard about him was that defense is a problem. He's probably going to have to move to left field or right field. But, man, he can hit. He's kind of – it's exactly the same thing that happened with Dustin Ackley in Seattle where, you know, he's not – he doesn't have the glove to play second, but he can fall out of bed and hit 300. Well, the exact opposite's happened, and I don't know what to do about it because it's concerning.
And but the worst part is that you can see it. From time to time, you will see him get on a pitch or just get a hit, anything, and you'll be like, okay, that's the talent right there. You know, that's this big bat that we've been waiting for. And he is his own demon. And it's so frustrating to watch because if somebody could just get through to him, maybe take a few Red Bulls away, you know, and I think they need to, you know, because I've seen so many things that Mottola has said about him in interviews and whatnot, and I've said it to a lot of people. It's almost like they're too chicken shit to do something about it because they recognize the problem, and you know they let him know about it, but they don't want to tinker with it too much. And it's like, well, eventually you're going to have to start tinkering with this, or the same stuff is going to keep happening over and over again.
I completely agree, and in our episode tomorrow, which will be more your conventional episode, we're going to get into Lowry a lot more because he's playing second base. So, our final infielder, I guess, more of an unfielder though, is Mark DeRosa. What about him?
Actually, you know what? I gave him an A because I can't imagine them expecting anything better than what he's given. You know, a lot of good professional at-bats, you know, take his walk, got some really great clutch hits. They basically expected him to just be a leader and not play a whole lot, and I can't imagine expecting more out of him.
Yeah, I can't necessarily argue with you. I gave him a C+, though. Though you're kind of convincing me a little bit here because, you know, he's played second base if he's been asked to.
Played first. I mean, he wasn't supposed to really play. He was supposed to be, you know, the leader, the last man leader on a club that is supposed to win the division. Basically what he's done the past couple years. And on a team that takes really crappy at-bats, he takes some really good ones and has got a really good walk rate and has got some real clutch hits. And he's one of the very few guys in this team with a positive win percentage, so, you know.
I mean, and he also is slugging over 400, which he had not done since 2009.
Yeah. Well, he's been really banged up the past few years. He's finally healthy.
Absolutely, but he's back healthy. That on-base percentage has crept over 300. So,
I mean, he's obviously not going to be like a regular player or whatnot, but for a 25th guy who was there to, you know, be Crash Davis for Brett Lowry, you really can't expect more than what he's given.
No, and I think we should go back to I know that I was on board with Lind playing every day because he was hitting so well. But I think DeRosa should go back to playing against more of the lefties.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing him sit against lefties here and there just to see if he can get his groove back again. Or, you know, maybe give it a shot after the All-Star break, see how he does, see if he continues to regress a little bit and then go from there.
Yeah, I'm jumping around here a little bit out of order because I don't want to end on a negative. So let's do Melky Cabrera now. I gave Melky Cabrera a D. I could have thought about giving him an F. some of the worst outfield defense I've ever seen in my life. I don't necessarily entirely blame him because he should have been on the bench or on the DL or DHing. But not good at bats, not patient at bats, which is what we expected to get out of him. Hasn't shown any power. He's a below average hitter, and he's playing a corner outfield spot really badly. So
I too gave him a D, and the only reason I gave him a D instead of an F was because he's got an excuse. He's been, you know, some guys be like, well, he's been playing on one leg. He hasn't been playing on any legs, so yep. It's an excuse, but when he comes back healthy, I expect a lot more out of him.
I completely agree. So kind of dealt with him nice and quickly.
Not much to say about Melky, let's be honest.
Exactly. Chris, one of your favorite players next, Rajay Davis.
Rajay Davis. All right. Well, you know what? I actually gave him a B because he hasn't been as putrid as he's been in the past. When he's been thrown back into the everyday role, he has gone back to being the Rajay Davis that we all know and hate. But I don't think that you can ask much more of what he did. You know, he came and started against lefties, did great. Still a bad defender, but his base stealing's gotten better. I came really close to giving him an A, but I stuck with a B.
I went with a B as well, and the base stealing is the reason why. Last year he led the major leagues in caught stealing, which is the only black ink on his baseball reference page, but not in a good way this time. And he's only been thrown out three times thus far this year. If you compare that to Bonifacio, who's already been thrown out five times, and Davis has twice as many steals. His legs have been a distinct weapon. And if they were to have kept protecting him against the right-handed pitching, I would have given him an A.
Yeah, so he would have looked a whole lot better. But then they stuck him in there to start for Melky. And, you get the real Rajay Davis.
And right, he's got over 100 plate appearances, 250, 300, 290. You know, it just,
we know this is Russia. We know exactly what you're going to get out of him.
And those at bats should be going to Anthony Ghost. We keep hammering it, but
they should. He listens. They all want Kevin Pillar.
Oh, don't get this. So last two guys, we have Jose Bautista, the All-Star. Take it away.
It might surprise a lot of people, but I actually gave him a B. He's been the second best hitter on the team, yes. Defensive metrics like him this year, yes.
Too much.
But the slumps that he's been on two this year, have been really bad. And I had to drag him down from an A because of that. Because if we're looking at this as grading on expectations, you don't expect your leader, your best player, et cetera, to go on horrible slumps like he has gone through, like weeks long slumps. Like it's no good.
Yeah, and while you could be tricked into thinking that he's having a much better year, because at the All-Star break he's provided more value than he did last year, even though he was hurt, that's dragged up by very unsustainably high fielding metrics, which are not true, frankly. Yes, he has a good arm, but that's the only nice thing you can say about Jose's defense. People refuse to listen to this. He's not a good defensive outfielder. I gave him a B plus as well. Didn't drag him down for him an A. You know, at the plate, he's been fine, but as you said, the inconsistency is still there.
It's just not what you expect from him. That's the thing. Like, you know, if we were doing this on just like, you know, just basic grades, I'd probably give him an A. But it's just not what you expect going into the season, a vital season. You finally go all in, and you got the leader of the clubhouse. You got the big money guy. He's the guy that, you know, they started to build around, I guess you could say. He's supposed to be the go-to guy. Out of all this, you know, he's supposed to be the guy. There's no questions about him. And yeah, there was that one, I believe it was June, that stretch there where he was, He was really bad. He wasn't even taking his walks, and that was what's weird, because with a guy like Jose, if he goes on a week-long slump, he's still taking walks, and he wasn't even doing that. So,
that was so finally, our last player, and one of three players that I gave an A-plus to, is Colby Rasmus. I was not a Colby Rasmus fan coming into the year. I had my doubts as to whether he should be signed long term. Those doubts are largely gone, and the reason why is because of his defense. While I don't necessarily trust that, like Fangraphs is telling me, he's 8.8 runs above average, his defense has turned around dramatically. He's stopped getting the brutal jumps on the ball. And then at the plate, he's got 16 home runs. He's almost slugging 500. And it looks quite sustainable. He's always going to strike out a lot. But you can put up with that if he's giving you the defense that he is and if he's hitting the ball out of the ballpark. Essentially, according to Fangraphs, if you want to discount Bautista's defense a little bit, he's the best player on the team this year, which I wouldn't have believed coming into the year.
I still don't believe, just because I don't believe the metrics are that good for Colby, but he has improved. I will admit that he has definitely improved on the jumps and whatnot, like you said. I don't think it's that good, but for a while there, he was an absolute vacuum out there. And he's still not hitting great against lefties, but he's destroying righties. I gave him an A+ too.
Is a vacuum a good thing?
Yeah.
Okay, because without fielders, I wasn't sure. So I thought you might have been saying that he sucked. So.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
No.
Third baseman, I can understand it, but
sucking up every ball. We'll
sure.
Put it that way.
Yeah. Anything else on Colby?
No. Very pleasantly surprised, because I was starting to have my doubts. I was very excited when he was traded here. And two miserable seasons made me think, okay, this is going to be another toolsy guy who goes off to the shed. But no, this is a very positive first half. I'm not saying, oh my God, sign him now. Although, I don't know, it's very tempting, but he's done this before. You know, we'll see how he does in the second half, if it's sustainable. But I love what they did with his new swing this year. They decided on one. They stuck with it. I think he looks comfortable in it. I think he feels comfortable. The results are there. And if I was a betting man, I would say he continues this and he doesn't fall off a cliff in the second half like he's done before.
I completely agree.
And I say, yeah, I think you might have to think about locking him up pretty soon.
He's only got one more year of arbitration left.
Yeah.
So, those are all the guys we're going to talk about. Unlike the pitching staff, which had 15 guys who we didn't talk about, the only players who did not get discussed were Anthony Gose, who we did actually manage to discuss in there somehow, and Andy LaRoche. So that's 30 at-bats of, let's call it, replacement level.
Yeah.
So that would lead you to be positive, but like we heard from Will Carroll way earlier in the year, this team can't keep pitchers healthy, and they're very good at keeping batters healthy. So yeah, that trend continues.
Absolutely.
So right now, we will go to an interview with Baseball Prospectus' Ben Lindbergh, talking about the defensive improvements from J.P. Arencibia and other catcher framing related things, and then we'll be right back. And welcome back to the Blue Jays Plus podcast. Joining us now is Baseball Prospectus' editor-in-chief, Ben Lindbergh, adding to our bevy of Baseball Prospectus guests that we've had. I think you're our seventh, Ben.
Wow. Well, I'm either honored on behalf of Baseball Prospectus or insulted on behalf of me.
Excellent. So we, as sort of the person who's embraced the catcher framing revolution more than anyone, it seems, we thought it would be good to have you on to break down some of the things that we've seen
in regards to JP Arencibia lately. First of all, could you sort of explain how catcher framing is measured and sort of the methodology that goes into it?
Yeah, it's funny that I've become identified with this to some extent, because I'm almost solely building on and writing about research done by other smarter people, which I've kind of tried to publicize because I think it's really interesting. And because, you know, how many subjects are there to write about that we haven't all been writing about for decades? This is kind of an original thing with an original angle, so I find it interesting. When I do my very, very simple kind of this week in framing, where I look at some of the best and worst from the past week, which tends to come out at BP on Friday or Saturday, I just do a very, very simple method. Doesn't really adjust for all the various factors that can affect whether a pitch is called a strike or not. It's just sort of looking at, you know, how many pitches outside the strike zone were called strikes and how many inside the strike zone were called balls. Defining the strike zone as just sort of the area that's typically called a strike, not the actual rulebook strike zone. But the research that some other BP authors have done, like Mike Fast, who is now an analyst for the Astros, and Max Markey, who's an author of ours in Italy, who's done a lot of the recent framing research, they do much more in-depth, very complex, very computationally intensive methods, where they try to adjust or account for as many of the factors that can influence this stuff as possible. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily perfect. There's a lot that we're still kind of feeling out, but there are just so many things that can affect whether any given pitch is called a strike or a ball. Obviously, the umpire is a big factor, as we've always known, but, you know, the count is a big factor. The count is, the strike zone is much bigger and smaller on certain counts, and pitch type can be a factor, and the game situation and the batter and the pitcher. So he just kind of, he plugs all of this stuff into his model and his regression, and he tries to kind of isolate each of those things. So he'll look at, you know, whether this pitcher tends to get a bigger strike zone when he's being caught by other catchers, and kind of factor that into the model, and then factor in what the count is and what the pitch type is and if it's a pitch that's more likely to be called a strike and all of those various factors. And at the end spits out this number that tells us, you know, how many runs the catcher saved, supposedly. So, he's played around with different implementations of this, adjusting for pitcher or not adjusting for pitcher. And it takes so long to run that he right now just kind of does like a once a month update of everyone. And sends that to me. So when I write some more serious thing about it, I like to rely on, you know, Mike Fast stuff and Max's stuff, just because they take so much more into account than I can on my own.
The main question that I have about this is, if catcher framing is so valuable, why did us not accounting for it earlier not cause massive problems in the war computations that we had in the past?
I think it's a question of who you want to give the credit to. In the past we've given the pitcher credit for this. You know, if he gets a strike, if he gets a strikeout on a pitch that's outside the zone, he gets the credit. He gets the wins above replacement for that. Or if he just, you know, puts a batter in a less favorable count and gets a more favorable outcome, the pitcher gets the credit for that. So it's sort of, you know, people used to say that pitching was 75% of baseball or 90% of baseball, and you can kind of come up with someone who said any number in between, but we've kind of moved away from that to some extent just in the last decade with, you know, fielding independent pitching and trying to separate what pitchers do from what their defenders do. And at BP and our wins above replacement stuff, we try to account for that with pitchers who are playing in front of good defenses or bad defenses. And if they're playing in front of a good defense, we'll give their fielders credit for that. And we'll take it away from the pitcher. So we haven't incorporated framing into wins above replacement yet. But if we were to do that, it would be the same sort of thing where we would just, you know, add that credit to the catcher for being able to get these strikes over and over and subtract it from the pitcher. So that would make some catchers happy and some pitchers very unhappy. But I think that's basically the principle. It's not like, you know, runs are just coming out of nowhere. Like we're, you know, just creating value that didn't exist before. It's just kind of a difference in who you attribute that value to.
Yeah, just to add on to that, I think that probably would be incredibly difficult to do. Like it's something like in war stats, because, you know, like to take away some pitcher credit and give it to catchers and whatnot, that is going to be incredibly difficult to do, because I mean they mm-hmm. are both doing it, right? So that's that's right, going to be a challenge for you
it's
guys.
It's a very sure. tough thing to untangle, just as pitching and defense is. I mean, you know, we look at fielding independent pitching now and we kind of try to separate those, but it's not clear that you can completely separate them. You know, we look at like team defense, but there's some evidence at least that, you know, a good pitcher can allow weaker contact sometimes, and maybe that makes the defender's job easier. So it is really hard to kind of unravel these things. And of course, we will never have this data for most of baseball history, you know, so we can't go back and really retroactively say that this catcher, this, you know, gets this much credit beyond a certain point. There's just, we don't have the information to say that. So it would have to be just something that we would apply to the past few years, if at all.
So in the past, you know, week or 2 weeks, there have been two different articles that have come out from competitor sites of yours, which have rated J.P. Arencibia's framing as fairly high. One of them at Mop Up Duty had him ranked fourth in the league, which seemed a little too good to be believable.
It was a poor article, like statistic wise. They didn't do a very good job.
Yeah, it's tough to do this stuff right. I don't even do it right when I'm doing my weekly thing, which I'm upfront about. But yeah, it's tough to do.
It was really easy to pick apart this specific article, though. Mm-hmm. I think you'd have fun with it. I'm not sure if you saw it. We can.
I looked at it when you sent it to me. Mm-hmm.
And then the other one was from Jeff Sullivan at Fangraphs, former guest of ours, who rated JP as the fourth most improved in the league, which seems a lot more believable. Because he has gotten better. But have you noticed anything with him? Have just any comments you had upon looking at those two articles?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't watch the Jays on a daily basis like maybe you guys do, so it's not necessarily something that I would pick up right away. I have kind of, you know, given him some abuse in the past because he, over the past couple seasons, just really didn't seem to be a great receiver. It wasn't something that you really needed advanced stats to tell you. You could just kind of look, and, you know, there was a lot of excess movement and sort of seemed to stab at pitches, and it wasn't just, you know, your blogger types saying this. It was, you know, the old school baseball guys who would watch him and kind of criticize his technique. And looking at Max's numbers for the past couple of years, I've got all these spreadsheets open that I'm looking at. And he was one of the worst, you know, according to these PitchFX-based metrics, where Max had him at like 25 runs below average, where below is bad. In 2011, and then almost 20 in 2012. So that, you know, rated one of the worst, and you looked at him, and it kind of passed the eye test or passed the sniff test, because he kind of looked like someone who that would be true of. And that seemed to be the case even into this year. You know, when I was doing my weekly framing things, there were a couple times where he came up as having particularly poor receptions on pitches that I included in there, and it didn't seem to me like there had been any metamorphosis in him, but it does seem like there's something going on lately. You know, I mentioned that Max updates his numbers every month just because it takes so long to run all of these computations. So when he sent me his stats at the end of May, so 2 months into the season, he had Arencibia as 5 runs below average, which at the time was one of the worst. I think it was certainly bottom 10 or so. And then he sent me another update just at the end of June, so a couple weeks ago. And in that update, Arencibia rated average for the season. which would suggest that he was then about five runs above average just in that month or so of June. And it does seem like, you know, just watching him, it does seem like he looks a little more still. He looks, you know, I wouldn't say that he naturally looks like Jose Molina to me right now, but he looks, you know, he doesn't catch your eye as someone who's not good at this. And there seems to be some support for it. You know, Richard Griffin with the Toronto Star has written about this, how he's been working with Sal Fasano, who's, you know, the Blue Jays catching instructor, and how they made some adjustments to his mechanics. And he had some quotes from Aaron Sebia where, you know, he was basically saying that he didn't think he had any problem with it, that he didn't really, you know, think that he needed to correct his catching. But, you know, Griffin had quotes from people saying that he'd improved and he'd been working on it. And so that sort of supports what the stats say. Again, it's, you know, we have maybe over 2 years of numbers saying he's not good at this, and then we have a month of numbers saying he is. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily put as much weight on the 1 month over the 2 years, but when that 1 month is supported by, you know, this narrative of he's working with a catching instructor, they've made mechanical changes, and he looks kind of different, then you can lend it a little more credence, I think. So it should be pretty exciting for Blue Jays fans, I would think, because, you know, Aaron Sebia is kind of, I guess he was sort of on this border where if he was a bad defensive catcher, then he kind of wasn't a great starting catcher, you know, because he doesn't walk, obviously. He strikes out a lot, and when he puts the ball in play, he doesn't get on base often. So he had the power, and that was about it. So he was, you know, kind of a borderline starting guy, but if he's suddenly transformed himself into an average or above average defensive catcher, then suddenly he's, you know, he's an asset. He's playable. He's more than playable. So that's pretty exciting if true. I'll certainly be following it over the rest of the season to see if this keeps up.
Yeah, I would totally agree. You mentioned him sitting down with Sal. It was when they were playing the White Sox, I believe it was. They were in Chicago, and they called in Sal and sat down with him. And that night, I remember watching it, and I was like, whoa, when did he all of a sudden, you know, he has the elbow up and the different angle of the glove and whatnot. And I'm like, when did this start? And right. I started mentioning it on, like, Twitter and things like that, and you know, people mostly ignored it, and then it was about 4 days later when they mentioned it on the broadcast, and I'm like, okay, finally, people are starting to pick up on this. This is, like, as you say, passing the sniff test and whatnot. There was a clear difference, and like you said, you know, he's probably never going to be elite at this.
Right.
He's probably only going to be so good because he just doesn't seem to have the catcher instincts. But I've seen some things out of him that I never thought I'd see this past month. Include just the other day, he did a drop to one leg, Lucroy style, and just got a ridiculous call on a breaking ball from, I believe it was Burley, or it could have been Rogers. I can't remember exactly, but I never thought I'd see something like that. And of course, he still has his, you know, brain fart moments where he will,
right,
you know, let a bad pass ball go by or whatnot.
But, yeah, I've seen him get crossed up from time to time.
Yeah, I mean,
there's some miscommunication.
Yeah, it's going to happen. And again, I go back to the catcher instincts, which he just doesn't seem to have. But I think it's been a very pleasant surprise because we have all been extremely hard on him because it's been painful to watch the past couple of years, not only the K's, but behind the plate as well.
Right,
and,
yeah.
Something that we've been questioning for a while now is if a sit-down with a catching instructor can make that much of a difference, why isn't he with the big club? If they're going with J.P. Arencibia as a starter, you know, they trade away Darno, you know, they kind of put all their cards in on J.P., so why isn't Sal Fasano with the big club?
Yeah, I wrote an article for Grantland where I was just kind of interested in, you know, how teachable this stuff is, because it's exciting that we can maybe kind of quantify it, or we're starting to quantify it, and maybe we can recognize the people who are good at it and bad at it. But the really, you know, the real potential, I guess, comes if you can teach it. If once you recognize how valuable it is or how important it is, you can actually make someone who's not so good at it into someone who is good at it. So I went around and asked a lot of coaches and catching instructors and catchers basically how teachable it was, and The consensus, I think, seemed to be that it's more teachable than maybe most baseball skills. Like, you know, Russell Martin, who's a good receiver, told me that it's easier to teach someone to be able to do this than it is to teach someone how to hit or how to, you know, hit home runs. Those things, there's just a big natural, you know, talent component to it. Not everything can be taught, but framing and receiving, I mean, everyone told me that everyone gets better at it, at least up to a certain point, that it's possible to improve anyone, that a lot of it really comes down to kind of your makeup and your work ethic and whether you realize that it's important and you're willing to put the time in. But everyone said it could be improved, that, you know, you couldn't necessarily take someone who's not naturally gifted at this and make them into Jose Molina, but that you could take pretty much anyone and at least make them competent over time if they have the right instructor and they're willing to put that work in. And it seems like it's not often an overnight change, which makes this kind of unusual. I mean, most people told me that it's more about the repetition and about, you know, working in bullpens and catching pitches barehanded and doing drills and just catching thousands and thousands of pitches and over time getting better at this. And then, you know, once in a while you could just pick out something that someone's not doing right and just change him overnight and say, you know, well, just set up this way instead of that way and just overnight you'll be better. But that seemed to be the exception more so than the rules. So it would definitely be an unusual thing if, you know, Fasano just sat him down once and fixed him all of a sudden.
Which was so surprising for us, especially me when I saw him that night, all of a sudden completely changed.
Yeah, just night and day.
Like, you know, like the clock, like the when you describe the way that you hold out your target, like a clock, he was holding it more with his elbow up, like Molina style or Luke Roy style or stuff like that. And that we had never seen that before. We had always seen his glove way up, like pointing to 12 o'clock, like we were taught to do in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
So, again, an overnight change like that was shocking to me.
Yeah, it is. I think it's unusual, and I guess you do kind of wonder why, if it's that simple, if there's something so correctable and so easily identifiable as a flaw, you know, how you get to the major leagues without someone at some point sitting you down and say, hey, do it this way instead of that way. I don't know whether it's just that he became more willing or more receptive to, you know, to that kind of advice. Maybe before he just wasn't, you know, willing to incorporate that kind of guidance, and suddenly he was. But yeah, it's very encouraging and exciting, and it's a great story. I'll definitely be paying attention to him.
I'm seeing that you'll still see that most teams have caught up in the sabermetric analysis, with certain exceptions like the Phillies. But it piques my interest that the player in the league who is by far the worst at this is Ryan Domet of the Twins. The Twins being a team who is known for being old school, let's say, in their approach. Do you think that this is an area where, you know, you're going to find the next extra 2% being taken advantage of, where some teams will be lagging behind in using this to their advantage?
Yeah, I think so. That was kind of another thing I focused on in that Grantland article, just kind of talking to teams and trying to find out as much as I could about, you know, which are using this and how they're trying to implement it. And I talked to a lot of people with the Astros just because I figured, you know, Mike Fast is the guy who, in a way, sort of started this movement. I figured since he's there now, probably they're trying to put this into practice. And it did seem to be the case that they, you know, their minor league coaches told me basically that they were sent video comparing, you know, good receivers and bad receivers, and then sent studies that, you know, stuff on the internet and probably some proprietary stuff showing what the difference could be. And they were, you know, complete converts after seeing this stuff. So, you know, it's kind of a step from realizing that and accepting that to then doing something with it and either acquiring guys who are good at that or figuring out how to teach guys to become good at it. But I think, you know, certainly as with any baseball thing, you know, someone in that article told me that when any baseball team has success doing something new, there are just a ton of copycats that come after them and want to do the same thing. So I don't think it'll take too long to penetrate around the league. I'm sure people either already were looking at this or are looking at it now. I think probably some teams are quicker to embrace it than others. Some teams already had a good receiver. Some teams maybe had a guy who's such a great hitter that his receiving skills aren't quite as important. As for Domet, I don't know. I kind of marvel at the fact that he is still catching in the major leagues, because he just really doesn't look like a guy who's a great receiver. And now that we have the stats that kind of confirm that, it's surprising, I feel like, that he's still getting a shot at doing that, whether that's because the Twins are behind in some sense. I couldn't really say for sure. I think every team has someone working on stats, and it's sort of hard to say from the outside. I feel like we maybe have a tendency to think certain teams are ahead just because they've maybe hired someone we've heard of, you know, and someone who used to write for Baseball Prospectus or some other site, and so that makes them seem more advanced than some other team that maybe hired someone just as good but who didn't write on the internet first. So it could have something to do with that, but I couldn't say for sure.
Yeah, it's probably not a coincidence that not only do they have Domet behind the plate, but they also don't have very good pitchers at the moment. So
yeah, it seems like they've taken some steps to correct that. They started drafting and trading for some guys who throw hard and strike out people. It hasn't really shown up at the major league level yet. I think as a staff, they're striking out half the batters that the Tigers are, something like that. So that hasn't changed yet, but I think it probably will over the next couple of years.
Okay, last thing on JP. One of our colleagues, Steve McEwen, has noticed that JP seems to do much better while framing in critical counts, like two-strike counts or the like. But at other times, he seems to be much more focused on blocking balls in the dirt and things like that, which he also does have problems with. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you've seen? Is this a likely explanation to that? Just expand on that.
Yeah, I haven't looked in depth on him specifically to see whether his framing gets better or worse on certain counts. I know that I asked Max about this once, and he was planning to do an article on it and a study on it, because he had a theory that maybe certain catchers kind of bore down where it was more important to get a called strike, and so they would be more valuable because of that and that timing aspect. And he looked for evidence of that, and he couldn't find anything. So it didn't seem like there was really any tendency for certain guys to, you know, kind of be clutch framers, I guess you could say. It seemed like, you know, if you're good, you're good pretty much no matter what the count is. And I do kind of wonder sometimes, because, you know, when I'm writing these things, often I'll see that a guy won't get a call when he is concentrating on the runner very closely and kind of pops up and, you know, maybe feigns a throw to a base to get a guy going back. He won't get the call, that sort of thing. And Jose Molina, who's, you know, kind of the poster boy for framing, is not a good blocker. That's kind of the one thing that he doesn't seem to be good at.
We saw that for a couple of years.
Yeah, right. I guess you've seen that. Yeah. So whether that's because he's, you know, not the most mobile guy in the world, or whether it's because, you know, I kind of wonder whether it's maybe because he's so focused on getting the strike call that, you know, he's concentrating on staying still and presenting a good target. And so maybe he's a little slower to get to a ball that's in the dirt, just because he's kind of holding out hope that it will be within framing range. So I don't know Aaron Sebia specifically, but as far as I know, there's no real tendency for catchers to kind of become good framers at certain times and not at others.
I think what he was getting at with that, to be honest, is because Aaron Sebia is so new to this change. I mean, it's really only about a month old. Uh-huh. You see him slipping into how do you say it, like, just like old habits and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then if he's looking for, let's say, like a burly punch out with a nice sweeping curve or something on the corner, he just looks more focused on that pitch. Mm-hmm. I think that's what he was talking about with that.
So it's
because
not,
again,
because
it's
not completely ingrained yet.
Exactly. It just, right. Uh-huh. Because you see him get, he kind of flails at high pitches every now and then, still, like, mm-hmm. he's done for the past couple of years, where he doesn't really sell a high pitch. Sometimes he still kind of lets the ball catch his glove, mm-hmm. Which he did for the last couple of years. It was painful to watch that. I see that every now and then, because, again, it's been about a month since he's made this change. Right. So I don't think that we can expect him to be perfect all of a sudden. So I'm assuming that's what Steve was talking about when he saw that. Because, to be honest, I've actually noticed that here and there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm glad you've noticed this change and pointed it out. And he'll be in New York, I think, where I live next month. So maybe I'll have a chance to ask him about it.
That is excellent. This data from Max that you were mentioning, is that available on Baseball Prospectus?
It's kind of in bits and pieces, because, you know, he's consulted for teams in the past, and so that's kind of presented a problem when it comes to releasing the whole thing at one time.
Sure.
So not really, but if you look at his archive of articles, you can see some things, probably not everything, but there's always, you know, top guys and bottom guys, and sometimes he'll do a bigger dump of data.
And when could we expect catcher framing to be included in your wins above replacement player, Rick?
You know, we don't have a precise target date yet. It's something that we've discussed and we've been discussing for a while. You know, I guess we want to make sure that we have a good handle on this before we incorporate it into that. You know, we wouldn't want to be constantly tinkering with this after we add it in. So we'll probably continue to work on it for a while. I would expect that it's, you know, it'll maybe be a project this off season, I would hope. There are always tons of demands on our tech and stats people's time, but I'll be pushing for that certainly.
Excellent. So from that to a couple more comical things. On your podcast, Effectively Wild with Sam Miller, you guys get a lot of scenarios to change the game.
Yes.
And Sam Miller is most famous for his pit being added to the field, which the Blue Jays would probably not encourage, because Brett Laurie finds them without the pit being included on the field.
Right.
And your colleague at Baseball Prospectus, Matthew Corey, on his podcast has suggested adding a drop ceiling onto the field. Which mm-hmm. of these two would you prefer, and why?
I think I'm partial to the pit. I was persuaded by Sam's argument in favor of the pit. I, you know, in practice, the pit might not turn out to be such a great idea. You know, when the serious injuries start to pile up, and blood is shed, it might not be quite as amusing an idea as it seems to be on paper.
Why disagree? But I think it would increase the viewership, whereas the drop ceiling would kind of make viewing the game live a lot more difficult. So, yeah.
Yes, I agree. I agree that it would increase viewership. And yeah, probably the more bloodshed, I would imagine, the more people would watch. I don't know that we would all have the stomach for it in practice, but I like the element of unpredictability that it adds, and I'd like to see it tried out, maybe on a lower level first, then we'll see how it goes before we implement it in the majors.
Pitch it to Dan Evans for the Northern League. That's
right.
The starting
okay.
point there. Chris, yes, what would your opinion on this that. Game?
I'd go pit as well. Sorry. I'm all about the pit, even with Laurie.
Especially with Laurie. And finally, you seem to do most of your vacationing in my lovely hometown, or at least former hometown of Vancouver. Why is this, aside from it being the best city in the world?
Well, I have family there. It's a little known fact that I am a half Canadian person. I'm a Canadian citizen. I'm a dual citizen, so I go both ways. So that's part of the reason, and that I'm visiting family there, but that's probably the least of the reasons at this point, because, I mean, I've been going there every year, maybe, and multiple times in some years since I was small, and it's kind of almost a home away from home at this point, and it's really a beautiful city. I mean, I've always lived in New York, and I've never really felt that I would move unless, you know, work required it or something. But if I were going to relocate at some point, it would probably be to Vancouver. It's just a beautiful place with a nice climate. It rains a lot, but I kind of like rainy days sometimes. And there's just there's such a wide range of activities you can do there without really going far from the city. You can be skiing, or you can be fishing, or you can be hiking, or you could be doing regular city things that you would do in any other sort of city where those other activities wouldn't be possible. So it's a great place. Why did you leave? You should never have left.
My work has caused me to leave, but I think it's going to be short term, because I need to get back somewhere that I can go surfing and skiing in the same day, which I've done on at least a couple occasions. So
yeah, I'll be there next month. I'm looking forward to it.
So will I, hopefully. Chris, you need to leave Windsor, because not
everybody
quite as glamorous.
Everybody needs to leave Windsor, believe me.
Chris, you got anything else?
I do not, no.
So thank you very much for joining us, Ben.
Thank you. This was great.
So we will be right back to wrap up when we get back. We're back. So after our first two episodes have run down the grades for the week, or for the players up till this point in the midseason, we will be back tomorrow with a regular show where we talk to Zach Mortimer of Baseball Respectus about Phil Bickford and Brett Laurie moving to second base and maybe a couple other things. So join us tomorrow. Go Jays, go. Yeah!
Yeah.